The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Carroll. Part 1, Continued. The contemporary most like Lyndon Johnson, in the opinion of Johnson City residents, was a youth 3 years older, Emmett Redford. We had two boys who grew up here who became presidents, they say. And indeed, Professor Redford, whose presidency was of the American Political Science Association, is the only other person who came out of Johnson City in the 1920s to achieve any substantial measure of nationwide prestige, even in a limited field. What were Redford's feelings about Johnson City? "Well," he says slowly, "I had no resentment. I liked the people out there. They were friendly, good people." He pauses for quite a long time. Then he says in a very different tone, "My feelings were escape, you see. It was a dull kind of life. It was boring. My God, it was boring. And there was always this feeling of insecurity, that you'd never have any of the comforts of life. And I couldn't see any way of ever obtaining any security in Johnson City. I couldn't see any way of accomplishing anything at all there. There were no opportunities in Johnson City. So my feelings were I had to get out of that town. I had to escape. I had to get out." Emmett Redford was a member of a family respected in Johnson City. What was it like to live in Johnson City and be a member of a ridiculed family, a family like the Johnsons? During this period of his life, Lyndon Johnson was to say, he dreamed, over and over, the same terrible dream. In it he was sitting alone in a small cage, bare except for a stone bench and a pile of dark, heavy books. An old woman walked by, holding a mirror, and catching a glimpse of himself in it, he saw that he had suddenly turned from a teenage boy into a gnarled old man. When he pleaded with the old woman to let him out, she would instead walk away, and when he awoke, dripping with sweat, he would be muttering in the night, "I must get away, I must get away." Many of Lyndon Johnson's dreams were related to interviewers for a carefully calculated effect. But this dream, real or invented, seems to reveal true feelings, for these feelings are corroborated by outside, independent sources, the recollections of people who knew him, as well as by his actions. Emmett Redford wanted to get out of Johnson City. Lyndon Johnson was desperate to get out. He refused to get out by the road his parents had mapped for him, though, and by refusing to take that road, he gave them one of the most painful wounds it was within his power to inflict on them. They had always assumed, this couple to whom their children's education was so terribly important, that he would go to college. But now he said he wouldn't. His mother kept trying to reason with him, telling him, in the words of Ben Crider, the older boy whom she enlisted in the struggle, that without an education, you couldn't get anywhere in life, that she knew he had the qualifications and she wanted him to be important, to make good. She never, in the memory of Lyndon's friends and siblings, raised her voice or lost her temper, just kept trying to persuade him to go, telling him that he had a good brain and should work with it, instead of his hands, to get ahead, telling him that if he didn't go to college, he would never learn to appreciate the beauties of literature or art, would never really learn the history in which he was so interested. Kept trying to persuade him and encourage him, telling him she knew he would do well there. Her big struggle was to get Lyndon to go to college, Crider says, and she never gave up. Describing the struggle, Louise Casperus says, "Hope Springs Eternal was written about her." Sam at first tried to reason with him, telling him that without an education all he could look forward to was a life of physical labor. Then he flatly ordered him to go. When Lyndon flatly refused, he tried insulting him, shouting, "You don't have enough brains to take a college education." Neither his mother's pleading nor his father's shouting moved him, however. His need to stand out, to be somebody, to dominate, hadn't abated. Now, more than ever, his friends recall, Lyndon was always talking big. Once, when he said he would be a congressman one day, and Fritz Koeniger laughed, Lyndon said, "I'll see you in Washington," and he wasn't kidding at all. but according to a girl who went to the only college in the Hill Country, Southwest Texas State Teachers College at San Marcos, to whom he confided some of his feelings during the summer following his graduation from high school, he was afraid he couldn't be somebody at college. Academic standards were much lower at Southwest Texas than at the University of Texas, but Lyndon was afraid they were too high for him. Johnson City High wasn't an accredited school. Before a Johnson City graduate could be admitted, in fact, he had to take examinations to prove he was up to college level in his courses. Says the girl, Lyndon's cousin Elizabeth Roper Clemens, "He didn't have a full education, and he knew it." And, Mrs. Clemens says, although tuition at Southwest Texas was low, much lower than the university, for example, he would have to work while at school. And going to school as just another poor boy, well, that wasn't something Lyndon wanted to do. But perhaps there was something else behind Lyndon's attitude. College, the world of books, of truth and beauty, of the poetry his mother loved, of the ideals and abstractions so dear to his mother and father both, was the very essence of his parents' way of life, of everything important to these two people. He had seen what their way had got them. He had seen what it had got him. And he refused to go to college. If he wouldn't go to college, his father said, he'd have to work. The state was gravel-topping 6 miles of the highway between Johnson City and Austin with gravel from the banks of Miller Creek. First, so rocky were those banks, the gravel had to be loosened with pickaxes. Then it had to be shoveled into mule-drawn wagons. The boards that formed the beds of the wagons had been loosened, and after the mules had hauled the wagons into position on the highway, the boards would be turned so that the gravel fell through onto the road, where it was smoothed out with rakes. Only the pickaxing was easy. For what the axes loosened was not soil, but that hard hill country rock, so that the shovelfuls that had to be lifted up into the wagons were heavy, and the wagon boards had to be turned by hand, turned with piles of rock on top of them. The hands turning those boards, and lifting those shovels and tugging those rakes through rock, were young hands, for most of the workers were Johnson City teenagers. Some of the hands were calloused, the hands of boys accustomed to farm work. But the hands of 15-year-old Lyndon Johnson weren't. Nor was Lyndon strong or physically coordinated or accustomed to working. One night, the foreman, Floyd Farrell, came home and sarcastically told his wife, "That boy can't even hold a shovel." For Lyndon, the work was almost as brutal as it was for the girls working beside him. In that summer of 1924, $2 a day, the wage the state was paying, was precious in the hill country, and any pair of hands that could bring it home had to do so. "We had to work like men," says Ava. Her pretty sister Margaret was working, too, during their school vacations. Despite their mother's thriftiness, their father was on the verge of losing his farm to the bank that summer. "That was work I'll never forget." Lyndon had always hated physical labor. Ava remembers him at the age of no more than 9 or 10, whispering to her as they and their friends picked cotton in someone's stony fields, a score of skinny little backs stooped over in the burning sun. "Boy, there's got to be a better way to make a living than this. I don't see that there's any future in this." This road work, the only work available in a drought-stricken hill country, was even harder than picking cotton, and Lyndon hated every minute of it. Ava remembers him tugging at a wagon board beside her and grunting, "There's got to be a better way." But he did it, rather than do what his parents wanted. More and more frequently now, he wouldn't get up on time. Coming into his room, his father would say harshly, "Come on, Lyndon, get up. Every boy in town's got an hour's start on you, and you never will catch up." He continued to sneak the car out at night, and his father grew angrier and angrier. Then one night, while driving a group of older boys to a bootlegger's still, he ran the car into a ditch and wrecked it, and standing there on the lonely country road said, "I just can't face my father." "Money was scarce," recalls one of the boys present, "but we put in our nickels and dimes and got Lyndon enough money so that he could run away from home." He slept in the wrecked car. In the morning, hitchhiked to Austin, and from there took a bus 160 miles south to Robstown, in the cotton country near Corpus Christi on the Gulf, where his cousins, the Ropers, lived. When he arrived, his cousin Elizabeth recalls, he said that working on that highway was just too much for him, and he wanted to find a job where he could use his brains instead of his hands. But the only job he could find in Robstown was in a cotton gin. The Roeder and Kether Gin Company was a long, low building filled with the clank of pulleys, the roar of machine belts, the whine of the high-speed saws that cut the cotton lint away from the seeds, and the heavy thuds of the huge hydraulic pump press that hammered the cotton into bales and pounded steel belts around them. Hot as it had been out on that highway in the hill country sun, it was hotter inside the gin, with the Gulf Coast sun beating down on its tin roof and fires roaring under the big steam boiler. The air in the gin was so thick with the dust and lint that drifted up in clouds from the cotton as it was pounded into bales by the pump press, that men working in it sometimes found themselves gasping for breath. And Lyndon, working amid the roar and the whine and the pounding that must have been very loud to a boy from the hill country, where the gins were tiny, almost toy-like devices compared to this, was put to work, 11 hours a day, keeping the boiler supplied with wood and water. And it was explained to him that if he ever let the water run out, or if the pop-off valve for some reason failed to work and too much steam was kept pent up inside, the boiler would explode. Several had exploded in Robstown gins that summer. He was terrified. The work was hot, and he wanted to come home, a Johnson City friend, Fritz Kuniger, recalls. But he didn't want to come home and be punished. So he wrote to Ben Crider, and Ben told his brother Walter to bring it up with Mr. Sam. Walter asked him, "Have you heard anything from Lyndon, Mr. Johnson?" "No, his mother is worried to death about him." Pause. "And so am I." "Well, Ben's got a letter from him," Walter says, "and he says he's working on a steam boiler down in Robstown. Those old steam boilers are mighty dangerous. The people down there won't work on those boilers." Sam got up and walked down the street in a deep study. Then he swung around and walked back and said, "Walter, here's $10 for gas. You drive down there just as fast as you can and get Lyndon and bring him home." Then Sam went home and telephoned Robstown, telling Lyndon to come home with Walter. But Lyndon wouldn't let his father know he wanted to. Pretending that he was having a good time where he was, he said he would come home only if Sam promised never to punish him for the car wreck, or even to mention it. And when his father finally agreed, Lyndon insisted that his mother come to the phone and say she had heard the promise, so that in the future he would have a witness. And thereafter, whenever Sam, angry at Lyndon, would start to bring up the car wreck, Lyndon would say, "Mama, you remember he said he wouldn't do it." And Rebecca would say, "Now that's out, Sam, you promised." And Lyndon's father would always drop the subject. Lyndon could always outsmart his father. But if Lyndon's car accident was a topic banned from the Johnson household, Lyndon's college career was not, and conflict flared again and again as September approached. Johnson City was abuzz over the fact that 5 children from a single graduating class, the most in the city's history, were going to college, and the parents of the 6th felt very bad. In September, Lyndon drove to Kyle to visit the last of the original Buntons, his great-uncle Desha, who, tended by a former slave, old Uncle Ranch, who was almost as feeble as he, was dying, on the same ranch he had founded almost 60 years before and had managed to hold on to ever since, and would be able to pass on, unencumbered by mortgage, to his sons. But if Lyndon was offered any financial assistance for his higher education, it was not sufficient to change his mind. On the day that 4 of his former classmates went to San Marcos to enter college, Kitty Clyde, of course, went to Austin, Lyndon went too, in response to a direct order. But he returned to Johnson City without registering, and stood sullenly under the lash of his father's tongue. And a week or two later, he ran away again. This time he ran not south, but west, to California. 4 older boys, discouraged by the lack of work in Johnson City, were planning a job-hunting trip to the coast in Walter Crider's old T-model, which they had purchased for $25. When Lyndon asked his parents for permission to accompany them, Rebecca became hysterical, and Sam flatly forbade him to go. Lyndon boasted that he was going anyway. told about the boast, Sam said, "Well, I'm just going to wait until they're all loaded up, and then I'm going to yank him out of that car." One Wednesday in November, however, Sam heard of a farm for sale near Blanco at a cheap price, and drove down to investigate. The boys had been planning to leave that Friday, but, Lyndon's brother says, the minute he, Sam, took off, Lyndon ran into his room, pulled his already packed suitcase from under the bed, and quickly called his fellow travelers together. In less than 10 minutes, they zoomed out of town at close to 30 miles an hour. Returning some hours later, Sam exploded in several different directions. I had never heard such rich, inventive language. Cranking the phone as if it were an ice cream machine, he called the sheriff of nearly every county between Johnson City and El Paso on the far western border of Texas, asking them to arrest his runaway son. But, for some reason, no one did. After Lyndon Johnson became president, he would frequently enthrall reporters and biographers with his dramatic description of this California trip, which he said he took because it meant one less mouth for my poor daddy to feed. In a typical description, he said the five travelers had been so naive and frightened, none of us had been off the farm for a trip longer than the road to town, that we'd camp out along the railroad tracks at night, and always our first chore would be to dig a hole in which to bury our money. The heaviest member of our party always slept over our cash. We didn't propose to be robbed. Finally, we came to a place where a hole in the ground was no longer necessary. The money we had just trickled away. When we were broke and job hunting, we separated. He remained in California for 2 years, he said, and during this time, nothing to eat was the principal item on my food chart. That was the first time I went on a diet. Up and down the coast I tramped, washing dishes, waiting on tables, doing farm work when it was available, and always growing thinner. When finally he returned to Johnson City, hitchhiking the entire 1,500 miles, he said, "The trip back home was the longest I've ever made, and the prettiest sight I ever saw in my life was my grandmother's patchwork quilt at the foot of my bed when I got home." Lyndon Johnson's description of the trip, however, no matter how enthralling to biographers, a passage in a typical biography reads, "Johnson was barely able to survive on the grapes he picked, the dishes he washed, and the cars he fixed. He lived the vagabond life." Is no more accurate than the reason he gave for taking it. Once California had been the frontier, the land of opportunity to the west, and in the hill country it was still thought of as the land of opportunity. "Everyone in Johnson City wanted to go to California," Louise Caspera says. "They thought you could make money out there." The five boys believed they were on the trail of fortune. They named their car the Covered Wagon. Arriving in El Paso, population 74,000, they were thrilled by it because it was the first time any of them had been in a big city. Traveling up through New Mexico and then across Arizona on plank roads, crossing the Colorado River on a ferry, they felt very much like explorers. "We had a lot of fun," Roundtree says. And when they arrived in Tehachapi, California, where a number of Johnson City boys, including Lyndon's close friends Ben Kreider and Fritz Koeniger, were working in a cement plant, while only two of the travelers could obtain jobs in the plant and two others did indeed pick grapes and do other farm work in the San Joaquin Valley, if Lyndon Johnson picked any grapes, he picked very few. His cousin Tom Martin, son of the well-known attorney Clarence Martin, had become a prominent attorney himself in San Bernardino, and what Johnson actually did as soon as he arrived in California was to telephone Martin and ask if he could work as a clerk in his law office. Martin, after calling the Johnsons and obtaining their consent, agreed. He drove to Tehachapi to pick Lyndon up and took him straight to the best men's shop in San Bernardino, where he bought him two expensive suits and then brought him to his home, a four-bedroom ranch house. And what Johnson actually did from beginning to end of his fabled stay in California was not tramp up and down the coast with nothing to eat, washing dishes, waiting on tables, doing farm work, but work in his cousin's paneled office and live in his cousin's comfortable home. Yet if there was no poverty or hunger on the trip, there were terrors nonetheless. Martin had given Johnson hope. He promised to make him a lawyer. In California, as in Texas, he explained, admission to the bar required passing a written examination, which he felt, and Lyndon said he agreed. Lyndon wouldn't be able to pass, even after studying law in Martin's office. Not without more education than had been provided at Johnson City High. In neighboring Nevada, however, no written examination was required, and the oral examinations were very informal, especially when the candidate came recommended by a prominent attorney. Martin was friends with several prominent attorneys in Nevada, he said, and if Lyndon studied law in his office, no more than a few months would be needed. He would arrange with one of his friends to have Lyndon admitted to the Nevada bar. Practicing in Nevada wouldn't be a good idea, Martin said. That state was still sparsely settled and rather impoverished. But once he was a lawyer in Nevada, Johnson could be admitted to the California bar under a provision which made such an admission all but automatic for any lawyer from another state. And as soon as he was admitted, Martin would take him into his own profitable practice. To Lyndon, this seemed a chance, his first real chance, to be someone without bowing to his parents' wishes and going to college. Fritz Koeniger was rooming with Lyndon, who had persuaded Tom to let Koeniger work as a clerk in his office, and, Koeniger says, Lyndon wanted to be a lawyer, wanted it very badly. He threw himself into his work with an energy he had never displayed before. If at home he had had to be shouted out of bed, now he jumped up and dressed in an almost frantic haste, so anxious to get to work, in fact, that he developed a habit Koeniger had never heard of. Instead of untying his necktie at night, which would have required him to spend half a minute or so retying it in the morning, Lyndon would loosen the knot enough to pull it over his head and hang it, still tied, on a doorknob, so that he could just pull it over his head and tighten the knot in the morning. And when he got to the office, he not only raced to do whatever work Martin assigned him, but in every spare minute bent over Martin's big law books with a fierce concentration. He had always been ambitious, even back in Johnson City, Koeniger says, but there was a new level of intensity about that ambition now. He wanted to get ahead in the world, wanted to be something, and he wanted it so bad that he was aggressive, Koeniger says. He was very aggressive. Martin, as renowned an orator as his father, was active in Democratic politics in San Bernardino, and had been invited to speak at a Labor Day picnic. But the night before, he, Lyndon, and Koeniger had driven over to Los Angeles to a party for two Johnson City newlyweds who had come to California, and they had slept over. As soon as they started driving to San Bernardino the next morning, they saw that the holiday traffic was so heavy that they might not get to the picnic on time. The road had only two lanes, one in each direction, and both lanes were crowded, so that Lyndon, who was driving, had to get cars in his lane to pull off to the side of the road if he wanted to pass them. And the horn on Martin's car didn't work. And then, Koeniger says, and this is what I've thought of many times to show how aggressive Lyndon was, he'd pull right up behind some car and bang the side of his door, just smash it, hard, with his open palm so it sounded like a crash almost, over and over until they'd pull over. Chauffeur-driven cars, some of them, rich people out for a holiday. But that long arm would just reach out the window and just smash and smash. And the other car would swerve over, and we'd go by, and they'd glare at us. I wouldn't have done that, but Lyndon was just determined to get there on time. He did. They arrived, just as the master of ceremonies was asking, "Is the Honorable Thomas J. Martin in the audience? He is scheduled to speak at this time." Martin shouted, "Here I am!" Koeniger was never to forget that long arm beating, smashing on the car door. For a few months, Lyndon's hopes seemed on the way to realization. Martin's practice was booming. He had impressed Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jr., and did legal work for him, and he also did a lot of divorce work, some for movie actresses from whom he received fees that sounded wonderfully large to the two hill country youths. He had a knack for publicity. Once, recalls Koeniger, he saved up his divorce cases for several weeks and then gave them all to his two assistants in a bunch. Lyndon and I took them down and filed them in the courthouse all at once, and we got a big headline in the San Bernardino Sun, because it was the most divorce cases ever filed in one day. And Lyndon was doing more and more of the paperwork in the office, and, Martin said, making good progress in his law reading. But there was more than one facet to Martin's character. He had blighted a brilliant career in Texas before coming to California. Elected to the legislature at 21, he had resigned to enlist—it was his seat that Sam took in the special election of 1917. and returned as a war hero with the lieutenancy and a Silver Star, awarded, the citation read, for his bravery in going into the front line, which was under severe artillery and machine-gun fire, in order to encourage his regiment. He was named police chief of San Antonio and had been nominated for district attorney when he became involved in a series of escapades. On one occasion, drunk, he and some friends drove around the city shooting out streetlights. He resigned and left town while a grand jury was considering an indictment against him. When, during the summer of 1925, his wife Olga took their little son back to Texas for a visit, she hadn't more than left San Bernardino on the train when Martin organized a party that was to go on, more or less continuously, Koeniger says, for more than 2 months. The key participants were Martin and his actress girlfriend, Lottie. Martin had, in Koeniger's words, a great capacity for Gordon's gin, and a bootlegger client, whom he had been keeping out of jail for years, to supply it. "Any time you need anything, just call," the bootlegger told the two youths, and on Martin's behalf, they called frequently during the ensuing 2 months, during all of which, Koeniger says, Martin remained pretty much drunk. While present at the party, it took place after all at the house in which they were living, Lyndon and Koeniger were more spectators than participants. They each had a girlfriend, but only to have someone to go to the party with. Lyndon's was Martin's secretary, who would come over from the office with him. Their relationship was platonic. What the two young men mainly did that summer, Lyndon with feverish earnestness, was try to hold Martin's law practice together, for with the onset of the party, Martin completely abandoned it. At first the task was fun. When a client telephoned, Koeniger says, he or Lyndon would in turn telephone Martin, and he'd tell us what to tell the client and to cover up for him not being there. When Martin was too much under the weather to be of assistance, they would decide themselves what legal advice to give. Lyndon and I were practically running the office. But it wasn't fun for long. We had to pay filing fees and other expenses that lawyers have, Koeniger explains, and we had to pay the office rent. Several times Lyndon mentioned to Tom, we've got to raise some money. The first few times, Martin gave him some, but then he grew evasive, and his two clerks realized he no longer had any to give. Lyndon and Koeniger had never been on salary. We had just kind of been sharing with Tom on anything that came in. They paid some filing fees themselves, and then some of the back rent, and found themselves, Koeniger says, flat broke. And the landlord began coming around to demand the rest of the rent. Then they learned that a mortgage payment was coming due on Martin's house. Lyndon Johnson, who had for years watched his father, broke, worry about losing his home, realized with a start that he was in the same position. And Lyndon had an additional worry. He suddenly realized that in advising clients when Martin was unable to, he had in fact been practicing law without a license. If one of the clients found out, he could be arrested. He could go to jail. And several clients for whom legal papers hadn't been filed as they had expected, because there was no money to pay the filing fees, were beginning to ask suspiciously what was going on. Whether or not jail was a real possibility, it loomed very real indeed for the two unsophisticated youths. Lyndon was terrified. They both were. Years later, with real feeling in his voice, Koeniger would say, "This was a terrible experience." And then Lyndon Johnson found out that he wasn't going to be a lawyer after all. In assuring him that he would be able to obtain a Nevada license, Martin had overlooked the fact that Nevada had an age requirement. A lawyer had to be at least 21. In this summer of 1925, Lyndon was only 17. He would have to wait 4 years. Koeniger isn't sure whether or not Lyndon had known this earlier, but he is sure, for he remembers his friend's shock and dismay when he found it out, that he hadn't known about another requirement. Martin had assured him that once he obtained a Nevada license, it would be easy for him to obtain a California license. California law, however, required that such reciprocal licenses go to attorneys who had been practicing in another state for at least 3 years. It wouldn't be 4 years before Lyndon could practice in California. It would be 7. And at the same time that Lyndon learned this dismaying fact, Koeniger says, he learned another one. Nevada was in the process of tightening up its previously slack requirements for obtaining a license to practice law. It was going to be much more difficult to obtain one without a college degree, so difficult that it might be all but impossible to obtain one with only a Johnson City High School education. In September 1925, Martin received word that his wife was on her way back from Texas, driving back with his father, Clarence Martin. When we got the word that Olga was coming home, of course Lottie understood that, no trouble there, Tom said, "Now you take the car and take Lottie back to Hollywood, and Lyndon and I will clean up. We've got to remove any trace of any woman being here." Olga never did find out, and when she came back, Tom said, "Now, boys, we're going to straighten up and practice law." But the young men had been too scared. "We didn't want to desert Tom, but we had resolved that when Olga came back, we'd leave," Kuniger says. "After this terrible experience, we had resolved that we didn't want to go on any more." As soon as Olga arrived, they left. Kuniger took the first job he was offered, in a box-making factory in Clovis, and couldn't leave San Bernardino fast enough, so thoroughly frightened had he been. And when, a week later, Clarence Martin started driving back to Texas, Lyndon Johnson went with him. In October or November 1925, less than a year, not 2 years, as he later said, after he had run away from Johnson City, Lyndon Johnson came back home. Just as his stay in California was not at all as he described it, neither was his trip back. He said he hitchhiked home. In fact, he was driven to his front door in Clarence Martin's big Buick. But coming back, while it may have been in luxury, was still coming back. Lyndon Johnson had gone to California in the hope of finding a way to achieve the security and respect he wanted without following the course laid out by the parents with whom he was in such violent conflict. For a few months, sitting behind Tom Martin's big desk in that paneled law office, acting like a lawyer, believing, because of Martin's promise to him, that he would be a lawyer, would be one moreover without having to go to college, as his parents wanted, he had been sure that he had found the way. He had been given hope. Now he had had to come back. The hopes had been smashed. Before he went to California, Stella Glidden says, he had been over at her house almost every day. Now she heard he was back, but for some weeks she never saw him. And then, when he finally came around again, she says, "I saw a changed person. Before he went to California, he was just a happy-go-lucky boy. When he came back, well, I saw a serious boy then. I saw a man. I saw what disappointment had done." He began running around with what Johnson City called the Wild Bunch, a group of young men older than he was 18, who prowled the countryside at night, seizing whatever pathetic opportunities for mischief the hill country afforded. Waiting until their fathers were asleep, they took the family cars and held drag races outside of town, or rendezvoused in the hills with bootleggers to buy a jug of moonshine. When they went to the weekend dances, they would pick up a jug first, and at the dance they would get drunk and start fights. They put Eugene Stevenson's buggy up on the roof of his barn and broke into hen houses and stole a few hens for whiskey money. While most of their escapades were harmless, some began to skirt closer to the law. When Lyndon and his friends heard that a German farmer, Christian Diggs, had made his annual batch of grape wine, they pried loose boards from his barn and stole a 55-gallon barrel, worth a not inconsiderable amount of money in hill country terms, and Diggs was persuaded only with difficulty not to go to the sheriff. They hung a few sticks of dynamite in trees in Johnson City and ignited them to scare the townspeople. That was just a prank, but it stopped being funny when it was learned that they had obtained the dynamite by breaking into the State Highway Department storage shed. That was a state offense, and the sheriff passed word around Johnson City that whoever had done it had better not do it again. "I always hated cops when I was a kid," Johnson was to say, and on this occasion he defied them. A few nights later they stole more dynamite and shattered the large mulberry tree in front of the school. The highway department put a watchman at the shed. After he fell asleep one night, Lyndon and his friends broke in, stole more dynamite, and hung it from the telephone line that ran across Courthouse Square. Then, Bob Edwards says, "We lit the thing and got in the car and ran like hell." And the ensuing explosion knocked all the windows out of the Johnson City Bank. The sheriff let it be known that the next time something like this happened, he would make arrests. Lyndon's grandmother Baines repeated her prediction that "that boy is going to end up in the penitentiary." And Johnson City, which had always known he was going to come to no good, felt that he was well on the way to fulfilling her prophecy. And perhaps so did Lyndon Johnson himself. Recalling his boyhood, he once said, "I was only a hair's breadth away from going to jail." His parents were terrified of what was going to become of him. His mother would hear no criticism. No matter what they came and told her Lyndon had done, it was always the other boy's fault for persuading him to go along, a friend says. But she could not blink the fact of who the other boys were. The Redfords and Fawcetts were in college, and Lyndon was hanging around with the Criders and other young men who weren't ever going to go to college, who were going to spend their lives working on the highway or on the ranches, who were going to spend their lives at manual labor. His father understood why Lyndon was acting this way. If you want to get noticed, he would say, there are better ways. Sam Johnson made other attempts to get through to his son. In May 1926, Lyndon again wrecked his father's car on a nocturnal drive, this time smashing it beyond repair, and again ran away, this time to the New Braunfels home of an uncle. His father telephoned him there, and Lyndon was to recall. "My daddy said, 'Lyndon, I traded in that old car of ours this morning for a brand new one, and it's in the store right now needing someone to pick it up. I can't get away from here, and I was wondering if you could come back, pick it up, and drive it home for me. And there's one other thing I want you to do for me. I want you to drive it around the courthouse square 5 times, 10 times, 50 times, nice and slow. You see, there's some talk around town this morning that my son's a coward, that he couldn't face up to what he'd done, and that he ran away from home. Now, I don't want anyone thinking I produced a yellow son, so I want you to show up here in that car and show everyone how much courage you've got. Do you hear me?" "Yes, sir," I replied. I hung up the phone, shook hands with my uncle, and left right away. For a while after this episode, tensions eased between Lyndon and his father. But soon he began to sneak out at night and take the new car without permission. Then in September, his father grew sick and had to lie in bed for months, since he was unable to work, bringing no money at all into the house. When he got up to put on his khaki work shirt and go back to the road gang, his emotions were noticeably rawer than before, and tensions rose. On weekends, Lyndon liked to sleep most of the day. His father, awakening him, would shake his bed violently. And when, one morning after Lyndon had sneaked out the car, Sam ran out of gas on the way to work, he came raging back to confront his son. When Lyndon, lying, denied that he had used the car, Sam slapped him in the face. Just with his palm, not his fist, but hard. Mr. Sam was a big man, says Edwards, who was present. Lyndon started to run away, Edwards says, but Mr. Sam yelled, "Come here, Lyndon! God damn you all, come here!" And Lyndon had to come back, and his daddy slapped him again. Lyndon was crying, "Ooh, Daddy, that's enough, Daddy! I won't do it any more!" But the next night he stole the car again. When, now, Sam stood talking with Rebecca about Lyndon, knowing he would overhear, there was a harsh tone in the voice in which he spoke harsh words. "Nope, Rebecca, it's no use," he would say. "That boy's just not college material." The strategy hurt Lyndon, but it didn't have the effect Sam had hoped. "If you want to get noticed," he had said, "there are better ways." But his parents' way was going to college, and over again during this year he said defiantly that he wasn't going to go. But Lyndon Johnson was going to go to college. Had he been as much a Johnson as his father, he might, like his father, never have gone. He might, like his father, have spent his life fighting the realities of the hill country and being crushed by them. But he wasn't primarily a Johnson. Beneath the foppish silk shirts was a Bunton. People might call Sam Johnson impractical. No one ever called a Bunton impractical. If there was only one way to accomplish their purpose, the Buntons found that way and took it. Once Lyndon Johnson fully understood the reality of his circumstances, he wouldn't go on fighting them. He may not have wanted to go to college. He may have been determined not to go to college. But if going to college was the only way to accomplish his ends, to escape, to get out of the hill country, not as a laborer but as something better, go he would. And after he returned from California, the Johnson who was also a Bunton was taught, the hard way, that there was indeed only one way to accomplish his ends. After he returned from California, he worked for the State Highway Department. The work started at dawn. 6 a.m. sharp was the time the State Highway Department cars left Courthouse Square for the job site, with the road gang on board. And this time the job wasn't merely gravel topping or smoothing off a road. This time the job was building a road. Because little mechanical equipment was available, the road was being built almost entirely by hand. It wasn't being paved, of course. In 1926, hill country roads were still made of that rocky hill country caliche soil that was as white as the limestone of which it was composed, and as hard. For a while, to earn his $2 a day, Johnson drove a Fresno, a two-handled metal scoop pulled by four mules. He would stand behind the scoop, between its handles. Because he needed a hand for each handle, the reins leading to the mules were tied together and wrapped around his back, so that man and mules were, really, in harness together. Lifting the handles of the scoop, Johnson would jam its front edge into the caliche. Urging the mules forward, he pushed as they pulled, pushing hard to force the scoop through the rocky soil. When the scoop contained a full load, he pressed down on the handles, straining with the effort, until the scoop rose free of the ground. Then, still pressing down on the handles with all his might, the reins still cutting into his back, he directed the mules to the dumping place, where he would pull up the handles to dump the heavy load. This was a job which required a strong back, says one description of the work. This, for a boy of 17, was back-breaking labor. When he wasn't operating the Fresno, Johnson worked with Ben Kreider, who had come back from California, as a pick-and-shovel team. He'd use the shovel and scoop the dirt up, and I'd pick it up out of the ground, or vice versa, Kreider recalls. And, Kreider says, such work was too heavy for Johnson. He would come home at night, work started at daybreak, it ended at dusk, exhausted. His skin, that soft white button skin, refused to callus. Blister formed on top of blister on his hands, which were often bleeding. He still tried to impress the other workers. At lunch hour, one says, he talked big, he had big ideas, he wanted to do something big with his life. But if he had ever had any difficulty seeing the reality of his life, it must have been clear to him now. He was down in that hated hill country rock, down in that rock for $2 a day, down working beside youths who knew that Kitty Clyde had jilted him because her father had predicted he was going to end up doing work like the work he was, in fact, doing. And the home he went to at night was again a home to which people brought charity. Sam fell sick again and stayed sick for months, and without income there was, again, no money in the house for food, and other families would bring cooked dishes to the Johnsons. He had started work in winter. It was so cold, Ben Kreider recalls. That was the worst part of it, getting so cold you had to build a fire to thaw out your hands before you could handle a pick and shovel. And we have done that many a day, build us a fire and thaw and work all day. Spring was more pleasant, but spring was followed by summer, the hill country summer where laborers toiled beneath that almost unbearable hill country sun, with their noses and mouths filled with the grit that was the dried soil the wind whipped into their faces. And summer became autumn, and then winter again. The first cut of the wind of this new winter may have slashed into Lyndon Johnson's consciousness the realization that this wasn't his first year on the road gang anymore, that he had been working on it for an entire year, and now a second year was starting, and he was still on the road gang. He had boasted to his cousins in Robstown that he was going to work with his brains, and not his hands. That had been in 1924. Now it was 1927, and he was still working with his hands. The boy who had wanted so desperately to escape from the cage that was Johnson City had not done so. This book is continued on cassette number 6, side 1.